Good afternoon, everybody. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to the Vox Pop for this Tuesday, April 24th. I'm Alan Shartok. President Trump is expected to meet with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un within the next month. On Friday, the North Korean leader is set to join South Korea's president at a border village in a rare summit between the two Koreas. The rivals technically remain at war because the Korean War ended with an armistice, not a peace treaty. And CIA Director Mike Pompeo is facing Senate questioning as he looks to replace Rex Tillerson as Secretary of State. Joining us, and we are very lucky to have him to discuss this and more, is Mark Dallas of Union College. He's the pro. So if you want to talk to the pro, he's it. Join our conversation, 1-800-348-2551. I said 1-800-348-2551. Your calls, much more, all coming up on the Vox Pop. Well, hello there, and once again, and welcome back to the Vox Pop, WMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm still Alan Shartok. President Trump is expected to meet with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un within the next month. On Friday, the North Korean leader is set to join South Korea's president at a border village in a rare summit between the two Koreas. Pardon me. The rivals technically remain at war because the Korean War ended with an armistice, not a peace treaty. And CIA Director Mike Pompeo is facing Senate questioning as he looks to replace Rex Tillerson as Secretary of State. And we're lucky about this. Joining us today is Mark Dallas. Dr. Mark Dallas is an associate professor at Union College. He specializes in international and comparative political economies, as well as East Asia. Mark, welcome back to the Vox Pop. We are very lucky to be able to call on you.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
Yeah. Mark, let's talk a little bit about Korea. I have a very simple question for you. You ready now?
Sure.
What's going on?
What's going on? Right. Well, should I just talk for the next 60 minutes?
Yeah, now? What's going on?
Well, I mean, it's pretty complicated, but, you know, this is kind of goes back into deep history also, post-World War II history. So it's not anything brand new, I would say. And, you know, especially with the U.S. and North Korea, they've gone through cycles, essentially, of more and less friendship, essentially, particularly on this nuclear issue. You know, one cycle would be after the collapse of the Soviet Union. There was a cycle of, you know, sort of negotiations and the two sides coming together and actually coming up with perhaps what is the best agreement we've ever had with North Korea. And that, you know, sort of fizzled, I guess would be the word. You know, both sides have a little bit of blame in terms of how it fizzled. That was probably our best chance. You know, the next cycle, I guess you could say, would be the six-party talks in the early 2000s. But that really didn't come to much of an agreement at all. And then really things really started to ramp up in terms of tensions between the two countries when they started really detonating nuclear weapons in 2006, basically, was their first attempt. So that's really, I mean, if you want to date sort of the current really heightened tensions, I would say, you know, around 2006, which that kind of killed the talks that had been going on since between like 2003 to whatever. It fizzled out probably in 2008-09, I would say.
Now, Mark, there's a narrative that is going on now that I don't much care for, which is that China doesn't like this rapprochement that's going on. And we had the specter of the famous train ride with Kim going to visit the Chinese. I've always assumed the Chinese were really in command here and calling the shots. They have a world economy that they're on top of. They didn't want the Koreans screwing it up. And that they had said to Kim, get it done. Whereas the new narrative that I'm hearing from people is China is very angry about this. I don't think this would be happening. But what about you?
Well, I think China might worry about what is going to be done without them in the room, essentially. And you have to remember that in the recent past, Kim has done things that were unfavorable to China.
So, for example,
Kim, the Kim Jong-un, his uncle, I believe his maternal uncle, was killed, and he was by Kim, you know, executed. Yeah. And he was kind of considered China's guy inside the regime. And then also the murder of his brother in Malaysia, he was also considered a China-leaning person.
Interesting.
So you know, those are, you know, I mean, you know, how much do you want to read into it? But, you know, if you look at those two events, you might say that the youngest Kim Jong-un has been, you know, sort of showing his independence from China. Now, those aren't massive things. It's hard to know if the only reason was to, upset China. It's hard to know if that was like the core reason for doing these
things. But aren't they deeply dependent economically on China?
Well, they are, but, you know, the U.S. has money too, and we could replace that potentially. So that's money is kind of everywhere. South Korea would be happy to, you know, chip in, and they have quite a bit in the past. In fact, in the past, when the South has gotten involved, it was called the Sunshine Policy, beginning with Kim Dae-jung in 2000, you know, that was kind of money-based. In fact, we now know that money was sort of transferred behind the scenes. Several hundred million dollars was transferred behind the scenes in order to get the Sunshine Policy started. And you know, the South has been willing to provide that kind of economic aid. So I don't think that China has a lock on it. I think it's more of like the norms that have surrounded that, that China has been the one that economically aids North Korea the most and accepts their exports the most. And right now, don't forget, you know, we've got serious sanctions. You know, the sanctions have really skyrocketed on North Korea. And, you know, there's a lot of debate as to whether sanctions work or they don't work. But between Obama and Trump, and by the way, the two of them actually, you know, this is probably one of the very few things that they might agree on. They've both been sort of hammering on the sanctions quite a bit in 2016 for Obama, and then 2017, Trump really reinforced them and ratcheted them up, I guess you could say.
So, Mark, can we trust the North Koreans on anything they say?
Probably not. No, I mean, if you want to use history as your guide, you know, I mean, if you look at, you know, I'm sure Trump is the type, I looked him in the eyes and I knew he was telling the truth, you know, okay, fine. If that's your, you know, your bar, then, you know, whatever. Maybe Pompeo has looked into his soul or something. But if you want to look at just empirically the history of things, you know, the North has not really abided by its end of the bargain, although, you know, we haven't done the greatest either in the 90s and the 2000s. But, you know, North Korea really hasn't either. I mean, they haven't really been forthcoming in the early 90s. In fact, they were really trying to essentially hide their nuclear program completely, even though they invited inspectors in. From the IAEA, the inspectors essentially were blocked from being able to see much of anything. And since then, you know, so for instance, after the agreed framework in 1994, which again I mentioned was when we were probably closest to having some kind of consolidated deal, you know, I think it was like 2 or 3 years and North Korea hadn't even declared it's how much plutonium it had processed. I mean, just basic, a piece of paper that said, you know, this is how much we actually have as the first step in that agreement. So it's hard to really trust, but then trust is really at the core of this. I mean, there's zero trust on both sides. United States and Korea. And, you know, it's one of these things now, at least, where you've got two people. They're pointing guns at each other and they're telling the other one to put their gun down first. And so, you know, if you're in that tense situation, who's going to be the one that's going to lower their gun first in a way?
Now, have you spent much time in Korea? I know you're married to a Korean woman.
Yes, I am married to one. Now, I haven't spent much time in South Korea. Yeah. I've never been to North Korea. Yeah. I have colleagues that have, more elderly colleagues that have been involved in North Korea.
And have they come home?
Yes, they have. Yeah. They were sort of, you know, low-level diplomatic ties. And my specialty is really kind of China, is really where
Let me interrupt then
sure,
and say
sure.
we keep hearing that China will never allow a reunification of the two Koreas. Not that I think that's likely to happen, but because of then having a potential enemy on their border.
Right. Well, I think they would allow a reunification of Korea under the auspices of the North. So it depends on who is going to be the one that's going to be absorbing the other and who's sort of in control of that process.
Now, why in the world would the South Koreans ever agree to that?
They wouldn't, except for militarily. So, you know, the North...
What do you mean militarily?
Well, I mean, you know, if one of the goals of Kim Jong-un is to reunify the peninsula, is most likely it's going to be through military means, combination perhaps of nuclear well as... the nuclear would be used to... prevent the United States from intervening. So you threaten, credibly threat a nuclear strike and say, don't get involved. Then you use conventional means to start to invade the South. Now, I'm not trying to say this is going to happen, so I don't want to, like, people to panic, but that is a possible plan. I mean, I'm not in the head of Kim. I'm not in the meetings with the generals, so the northern generals. So I don't know how credible that plan is, but it's a plan. It's potential. I'm sure it's on the table and has been discussed. Whether it's been discussed with China, I'm not sure. But under those circumstances, I think China would be more than happy for a reunification. So it's really reunification by whom?
We are talking this morning Korea. And it is great to have a real expert with us today. And we're very much appreciative of that, Mark. Let's go to, and Union College should be very proud of you. I would love to have a course with you. let's take a break, and we'll be right back. And now it's time for you to dial the number and ask the professor your questions. 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. I want you to call.
Support for WMC comes from Windhorse Naturopathic Clinic, Brattleboro, Vermont, offering naturopathic medicine, oxidative medicine, colon hydrotherapy, and acupuncture, specializing in Lyme disease, now accepting new primary care patients. WindhorseNaturopathic.com. College Street Motors, Amherst, Massachusetts, for over 30 years, specializing in foreign and domestic car and truck repairs, including tire pressure, exhaust, brakes, and checking engine lights, full-service gas station, CollegeStreetMotors.com. Vermont Coffee Company, offering slow-roasted organic coffee in the brown paper bag at local grocery stores. Vermont Coffee Company, coffee roasted for friends. The Arkell Museum at Canajoharie, presenting fine art animals from the collection of the Arkell Museum at Canajoharie through October 21st. More at arkellmuseum.org. And Elements Hot Tub Spa, downtown Amherst, Massachusetts, offering hot tubs in 5 indoor or outdoor private rooms, plus a team of massage therapists for individuals and couples. ElementsHotTubSpa.com for gift certificates and photo gallery.
And we are back, and we are delighted to be here with you, with Mark Dallas of Union College, specialized in international comparative political economies as well as East Asia. So if there's any question you have, now's the time to call. 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. Mark, the real question to me is, what's the historical relationship between Korea and China?
Well, it depends on how far back in history we go, but you know, it. I think the most important thing might be to start with sort of the World War II period and on, because we, you know, we could go way back, but you know, the core event that bound the countries together was, you know, the Korean War, essentially.
Yes.
And that really bound them together as, you know, big brother and little brother. And the Chinese really contributed tremendously to pushing back UN/US forces because, you know, I mean, you know, the North really started the Korean War in the sense that they invaded the South, and then, you know, eventually U.S. Forces.
General MacArthur.
Yeah, MacArthur, right, pushed them back. And, and the key decision was that he also then went above the 38th parallel and decided,
and
hey.
And that's when the Chinese came in.
So they were trying to take the whole peninsula in the U.S. and under U.N. Flag. And that's when the Chinese really came in and they reestablished the border at the 38th parallel. So that really bound the countries together. And ever since, you know, it's perceived as the great victory, really, of the past 60, 70 years for both countries in a way, because they defeated the imperialist superpower, right?
Eisenhower said, I will go to Korea.
Yeah.
And he went.
Right.
And I remember it. I'm older than
okay.
you.
Okay. Yeah, for me, it's a history book. And so so really, you know, that is in how that plays in the domestic audience is very powerful as well, in that that was the defeat of the imperialist superpower. The U.S. could be defeated. It was defeated by us, meaning, you know, the Chinese and the Koreans together. And that plays extremely well for the domestic audience as well.
Okay, so we'll go to Ted in Shelburne, Vermont, but not before I give the number once again, 1-800-348-2551. Ted, thanks for getting us started. Appreciate it. Go ahead.
Thank you very much. Well, I had a cousin who was an ambassador in Vietnam a while back, and so I started watching NHK, which is Japanese public television in English, and that led me to see somewhat recently, last winter, some boats, apparently fishing boats, that were driven by wind and currents from North Korea onto Japanese beaches, and as though, and there was some military connection, as though with the extreme food insecurity in North Korea, he had actually been, I've heard of military personnel used in agriculture, and also as though he sort of put them off season into fishing boats because the regular fishermen knew enough to stay home. Is that anything you have heard, or just the extreme food insecurity, I guess, is sort of the primary question.
Right. Yeah, Ted, that's important because obviously food is the foundation for any country. And yes, North Korea has had trouble feeding its population. It's been worse at some points in time. So as I mentioned earlier, the mid-90s, it was absolutely terrible. They actually went through a dramatic famine. So that is something that the military would get involved in at certain periods. But you also have to remember that Korea has used, for instance, you mentioned boats. They've also used seafood as exports in the past. So that was one of their export products. So they can also earn foreign currencies through the seafood as well. Whereas more conventional farming, let's say, the military could be, you know, dispatched essentially to try to, bolster farming, let's say, because they do have problems feeding the population oftentimes. But that goes up and down with weather and other conditions as well.
Right. I mean, this just seemed an extreme example of people being sent to sea for fish when they shouldn't have been or something in the fact that these boats were washing up.
Right. The other thing to keep in mind is that North Korean military also sometimes will absorb, males, let's say, excess males from the population. It's a good way to, you know, sort of keep them occupied, I guess you could fed and sort of out of trouble from something that the regime may dislike.
And another, just this is a quick one, but just a change that I'm not a super close or educated watcher, but both with the Olympics and then some other occasions I see on this, as I say, the Japanese news, but women like Kim Jong-un's wife and sister have been seen more in public than might be usual. I just wonder if there's anything, you know, coming together to make it more rational.
Well,
behavior.
I guess you could say they're sort of being used as diplomats. One of the big things for a regime like in the North is trust. And who do you trust the most? You trust presumably your family members, as long as you can trust the family members. But the ones that you can trust, you know, you might dispatch for important things.
And the other ones you kill.
Right. He's killed family members as well. So, you know, it depends. Obviously, that's a very subtle thing, you know, who you trust and you don't trust. But
reason to behave. That's a good reason to behave as a family member.
Yeah,
thank
but you want
I'll
want them
on the air now.
Yes,
thank
you want you. Them to also, fulfill what your mission is. And Ted, so presumably he trusts these.
Ted, thank you very much for your call. Appreciate
it. Thank you.
Okay, 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. Watch this, Mark. I'm telling you, it's magic. I'm going to say there's no one on the phone right now, and therefore your voice will be the next voice on the telephone if you can call really fast, and that's 1-800-348-2551. Now, what about that train to China? I want to ask that one. Clearly this was an extraordinary event. He gets in a train and he goes to China. And as you say, he has reason to suspect that maybe he's not the most popular guy over there because he killed the Chinese relatives who were basically not to his liking.
Right. Yeah. That was also a secretive trip as well.
It wasn't much of a secret. We all saw the train, right?
Well, no. Right. But okay. That was actually, so people who saw the train come in, it's a very distinctive train too. It's completely armored and,
it's
a special train. And his grandfather, actually, that was his means of transportation across the border, especially with China. So people suspected that it was him visiting, but it was not a declared visit to China. It was not publicized in China. There was no fanfare or anything. In fact, it was announced after he had arrived back.
So that's a pretty good hint, right?
What's that?
A pretty good hint that it wasn't announced there, that it wasn't something that they were going to be real proud of.
Right, exactly. It was only announced publicly in China when the train actually returned back in North Korea.
Well, it could have been security issues also.
It could be security issues as well. But the border between the two, if there's any border that they can cross peacefully, it should be that one. In fact, there's one bridge between the city of Dandong in China and North Korea where most of the goods actually travel over that bridge. So it's very, very localized. They did have their meeting. The Chinese are going to hide a lot of any kind of conflict. They're going to present that it was still brother-to-brother discussions and whatnot. By the Chinese media's perspective, it appeared to be, harmonious, let's say.
So here we go to Tony in North Adams. Tony, I promise you you'd be on, and now you're on. Go ahead.
Yes, good afternoon, Doctor. I was going to ask, what do you think the Japanese would think about a unified North and South Korea?
That's a great question.
Yeah, excellent question. If you heard the earlier part of the show, it depends on unified under whom. That's sort of the big question. If it's unified under sort of the North's auspices, then obviously they would be totally against it. A unified Korea under the South, given the current state of things, particularly with the North's aggression, I think the Japanese would be very much in favor of a unified Korea under the auspices of the South, similar to, let's say, like the union of Western and Eastern Germany or something like that, where there's a reunification process, because essentially it would eliminate what for the Japanese is their current largest threat by long shot, which is North Korea. And for them, that's top of the list in terms of sort of their foreign policy. The fact that the two have, that Japan was a colonizer of the entire Korean peninsula, and that they have a shaky relationship, the Koreans in general, but including the South, that's far, far down the list in terms of the Japanese concern. So I think they would very much favor, a reunification under the South Korean auspices and, sort of U.S. military direction, presumably. And I think this is one of the key issues about what might happen at the talks between Trump and Kim.
But historically, the Japanese are still not on first base with the Koreans.
Yeah, I mean,
service women and all the rest of this.
Right, and it's more about the lack of apology, I guess you could say, that the Japanese contrition that they've shown to the Chinese as well and the South Koreans. Yeah.
Yeah. Hey, thank you so much, Tony. Appreciate it. Right.
Could I say one more thing?
You may.
Dr. Alan Chartok, I listen to you every morning on the roundtable.
Right.
And I really appreciate that with you and Joe Donahue and your guest. Thank you again.
And thank you for calling, Tony. That's very nice of you to say. Thanks a lot. Okay, so We heard from our friend Mark, who says, it seems like Putin wanted Donald Trump to win the 2016 U.S. election. Do you think that Kim Jong-un also wanted Trump, or would Kim have wanted to see a President Hillary Clinton instead? Thanks from Mark, who is a man of peace.
That's a good question. I think probably Kim would have preferred Trump, if anything, because, you know, the Clintons and Hillary Clinton would certainly be much more savvy in terms of understanding North Korea. North Korea would have much less wiggle room. There's a long history there in the Clinton years of sort of difficult negotiations in terms of the Clintons and Kim's, well, I should say, Kim's father, right, in the 1990s. And so, you know, as sort of a neophyte, I guess you could say, they may very well prefer Trump. He's also somewhat of a loose cannon, as we know. So there may be room for greater room for maneuver.
But there were remarkable, Mark, there were remarkable insults passed between these guys.
Right.
One really wonders about whether any of that means anything.
Probably not. I mean, the caller's question was about the before the election. Trump's also, I'll get to the insults in a second, but Trump also, you have to remember, was talking about, hey, other countries need to foot their own military bill, right? So that would have sounded great to Kim's ears, telling the Japanese and the Koreans, you know, we're going to pull out, or we're not going to provide as many troops, or we're not going to fund the military nearly as much. And so that would have sounded great for Kim.
Yeah. We'll go to Javon in Hudson, New York. All right, Javon, you're on.
Yeah.
Hello.
Can you hear me?
We can, but not that well. Go ahead.
Okay, can you hear me a little bit?
Much
better. Yes. I am just trying to find out, like, if he have any answer about China. China has been making their footprint in a lot of small countries. Like, they be funding, helping a lot of small countries, building buildings and bridges and all that stuff. In particular, my country, I'm from Jamaica, and I know they're doing a lot of road work down there and all that stuff. And I've been listening to NPR all the time. I listen to NPR every day. And I know they in Africa and all that, and all that, where they are, you know, funding a lot of projects.
Okay, Javon, what's the question?
So the question is, what are they trying to do with doing all these works in all these countries?
Gotcha. Okay. We get an answer.
Great.
Go ahead, Mark.
Yeah. So, that's a good question. So it's really sort of their form of diplomacy, I guess you could say. It's sort of like money and infrastructure diplomacy in a lot of these places. And there's sort of a dual purpose to it. On the one hand, they often invest in countries, well, more than dual, but they often invest in countries where they require certain types of resources.
Like what?
Well, natural resources, for instance. Yeah. So, you know, they're really sucking in all sorts of mining, minerals, agricultural and other sort of raw materials.
Yes, because that's one. Yes, because that's what one of the things when you say they sucking in resources. That's my other thing, because I look at my country. We don't have much, but we have the red dirt where you get the minerals from, where you can use to make iron and all that stuff.
Yes.
A lot of bauxite. So, and I know they've been doing that to make steel and all that stuff. So I think that's the only resource I can see they're really getting from my country.
That's right. Exactly. That was going to be my guess as well, is bauxite. That's what they're there for. And in Jamaica. So that's one of their primary objectives. And of course, you know, the infrastructure, on the one hand, it makes countries pliable to allow them to give them rights to do these sort of things. But also you need infrastructure in order to get these things out of these countries, right? You need large ports. You need perhaps railways to get materials to the ports and things like that. So the Chinese use this, and it's their diplomatic reach to other countries, particularly countries that the United States has been neglecting. There's no coincidence that the United States States in Africa has not been very engaged in the past decades, and that was one of the primary places that China has entered, both for energy, oil in particular, but also other types of resources. So they're filling the gaps in between where the U.S. Has not been as engaged. Now, that doesn't mean all the countries. So Latin America, we've been very engaged, but, you know, and China has also been investing there, but it's largely for the resources. I hope that.
Okay. Thank you.
Sure.
Thank you, Javon.
Appreciate it.
All right. 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551 is the telephone number, the magic telephone number, which will put your voice on the radio. Well, it's very exciting to have you here, Mark Dallas. I'll tell you why, because, you know, the whole idea of what we don't know in this country is so great about other places. And you're in comparative politics. I once was forced into teaching a course in comparative politics when I taught at Rutgers. And I stayed one or two pages ahead of the kids. I didn't know much, but it was that or Vietnam. So that's what happened.
Well, it's daunting because in comparative politics, I don't know if people know how political science works, but in comparative politics, you kind of have to know everything but the United States in a way. We have one section just for American politics specialists,
right.
But then in comparative, you have to kind of know the rest of the world.
Yeah, well,
and that can be daunting.
Yeah. Yes, let's go to Bruce in Kingston. All right, Bruce in Kingston, you're on the air. Go.
Yeah, I have a question. Do you think it possible that there would be a unification, or reunification, really, of the Korean Peninsula, where a major part of the agreement would be the North Koreans would not put their troops into South Korea, and the Americans would withdraw their troops into Japan?
I don't think that would be possible to have a reunification like that. I mean, it depends on how you define reunification, but, you know, I think most people define it as a single political authority, not sort of a shared system, and so if a shared political or a single political authority is your definition of reunification, then that wouldn't work. That's just sort of a rearranging, you know, each side maintaining its control over that part of the country. It'd be you'd have to call it something else, I think.
Bruce, we're going to have to take a break. I thank you for your call. And we will be right back, and we'll talk to Kathy from Seward, New York. We'll be right back.
Support for WMC comes from State Street Fruit Store, Deli, Wines, and Spirits, downtown Northampton, a locally owned, community-minded grocery and specialty food store since 1922. Wine tastings every Friday, 4 to 7, statestreetfruit.com. Amherst Copy and Design Works, offering printing and copying, sign-making and design services, from booklets to stationery and labels to lawn signs, in downtown Amherst, Massachusetts, amherstcopy.com. Coldham and Hartman Architects, serving residential and institutional clients with architecture designed for resilience and renewability, designed for the next 100 years, CNHArchitects.com. Waterwheel Village, Galway, New York, a country store since 1923, offering aged cheddar cheeses, nostalgic candies, New York products and gifts, waterwheelvillage.com. And the Black Sheep, downtown Amherst, a New York-style delicatessen and European-style all-butter-scratch bakery, caterer, and cafe, offering fair trade coffee, blacksheepdeli.com.
So we're back. As Ray Graff always says, we're coming around with the big turn here towards the end of the program. Let's go to Kathy in Seward, as promised. Okay, Kathy in Seward, you're on.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call.
And thanks for calling.
Well, you're welcome. And, you know, I was just wondering if it's possible to make some kind of comparison between Kim Jong-un and his father, Kim Jong-il, or Ill, or whatever, you know, his dad, you know, and whether, you know, there's, you know, a difference there, things better, worse, Any opinion on that?
That's a great question.
That is a great question, because what's interesting is that sort of the structural conditions, meaning, you know, where is North Korea relative to other countries in the world, and what do they have to negotiate for and try to achieve? You know, those are actually quite different when he was alive, largely different when he was alive and right now. You know, in terms of their personality or things like that, I'm not exactly sure. And don't forget, everything is being looked through the prism of the state propaganda of North Korea. And in that sense, they look quite similar. They're both lauded as, you know, the great leaders, and in succession from each other, from the grandfather to the father to the son. And so, you know, and of course, you know, I've never met any of them, so I can't tell you personality-wise exactly how they differ in terms of their personality. But the conditions within which they're negotiating, I mean, it's the same basic topics that are being discussed. On the one hand, denuclearization of some sort by North Korea, and then a whole potential series of things that the rest of the world, or particularly the United States, would have to contribute, everything from, you know, financial backing of various sorts to, you know, non-aggression agreements to pulling out troops, you know. So those are the things that have been negotiated. But the key difference between these two time periods is really that Kim Jong-un now really has credibly shown the world that they are a nuclear power. And that was not the case with his father. And that's really what has dramatically changed now, is that they can really say, I mean, more, as much as India or Pakistan has tested nuclear weapons, the North has done more, actually.
And let me ask you this. Were there other siblings? Or there were, weren't there?
Yes, yeah, there were. You know, sort of internal selection, I guess you could say, you know,
he was not the oldest, right?
No. But often it's, you know, again, it's an issue of trust and capability
sure.
And who, you know, who would be in succession.
Yeah.
Okay.
You know, I think, in fact, that Kim Jong-un might have been the youngest.
I think that's right.
But I guess my question is more precisely questioning, do you think he was more of a dictator, or Un was more of a dictator?
I think it would be a wash. I mean, they're both trying to maintain control, and they're using the same state institutions to do that, propaganda, military, internal police, and whatnot, to maintain control. So I don't think there's been a dramatic change in how they rule.
Kathy, yeah. Thanks for your great call. Appreciate it. All right, let's go now to Evan in Bern. Okay, Evan in Bern, you're on.
Yes, hello. So my question is kind of part and parcel to the last caller's. During the end of Kim Jong-il's reign, I kind of got the sense that China was starting to kind of distance themselves from the North Korean regime. But since Kim Jong-un has taken over, it seems like he has kind of bridged that generational gap. He's doing a lot more maneuvering in terms of, you know, he's making his sister and his wife into a more diplomatic role and things like that. So I wonder how much of this is maneuvering to reinforce his relationship with China. And given your expertise on China, I don't know if you had any examples of that sort of thing.
Now, it's interesting that you call now. Did you not hear the first part of the program, Evan? Because I know Mark did. Yeah, Mark talked about it there. But let's go over that again, Mark, if you will.
Yeah, so I think overall, I think actually the relationship has gotten slightly worse between North Korea and China between these two periods of time, essentially. And as I mentioned earlier in the show, you know, Kim Jong-un, the son, the current leader, has sort of killed a couple of individuals, family members and individuals that were part of his regime that were considered to be sort of China-leaning or pro-China in one way or another. And I also think that, again, like I mentioned to the last caller, you know, one of the key differences here is that Kim Jong-un, the current leader, really has credibly shown the world that they are a nuclear power. And we really need to kind of wake up to that idea. The United States does as well. I think there's still deniers out there who are saying, oh, we're not sure he actually did it. I mean, he's tested nuclear weapons 6 times. He's sent, you know, very sophisticated missiles up into space and back. There's not much more that a country can do to prove that it's a nuclear power. Now, how does this relate to China? Well, you know, China does not want a nuclear power on its border either. I mean, you know, and the assumption, you know, it's dangerous for China to assume that the brotherly relationship, as it's been phrased since the Korean War, is going to necessarily continue forever. You know, nuclear weapons can be aimed whoever your enemy is. And, you know, you never want to have a nuclear power on your border. So the one thing that China and North Korea disagree over is the denuclearization of the peninsula. The North wants to keep it nuclearized, and China would love to see some kind of agreement where, you know, North Korea does denuclearize. So I know that sounds kind of weird, like, you know, but you know, again, as I said, nuclear weapons could be pointed to whoever your enemy is, and that can change.
Mark, do you think this guy would actually, Kim would actually use a nuclear weapon?
Well, I mean, you know, this goes to sort of like rational actor theory and mutually assured destruction and stuff. And, you know, I think he is a rational actor. So I think he would not use it unless, you know, there was some reason that he felt threatened, that his regime was threatened. But a regime threat doesn't have to necessarily come from other nuclear attacks. A regime threat could also come from conventional weapons as well. And at that point, it's like, well, why wouldn't I use it?
Evan, thank you very much. All right. 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. We're going to go to Ray in a moment, but here's an email from Julius, our very good friend. He writes, his name is technically Julius, but he always signs Jules. One day I have to ask him about that. And Jules says, Trump has been harping on the fact that the Korean War never ended. All the bluster about denuclearization, I'm getting to sound like Trump, denuclearization aside, if he wound up with a peace treaty, would he suddenly turn around saying, mission accomplished, I ended the Korean War? The answer, Jules, is of course.
Yeah. I think that would be, I mean, it depends on what the North Koreans gave up. I mean, you know. Just ending the war is not going to change the status quo. I mean, it will slightly, but, you know, there's still nukes in the north. There's still troops in the south. There's still the same tension. So just ending the war, while it would be a step towards something, I really don't think that that's going to be enough to dramatically alter the situation, because the North sees nuclear weapons as its lifeline to stay in power, essentially. And without the nuclear weapons, you know, the conventional war, they would lose a conventional war. It would be terribly devastating for both sides, the South Koreans, the U.S. military, and the North. But you know, the nuclear weapons really ensures the survival of the regime. So that's really what needs to be negotiated, in my opinion.
Let's go to Ray in Saugerties. Ray, you're on.
Hey, thanks, Alan, and thanks, Mark. You know, I grew up in the 1960s, and I wish there were no nuclear weapons, and I understand. I'm really happy that the North and the South are now talking, and I understand why he might want a nuclear weapon. It's because he doesn't want to be overrun, and it's his method of defense. But then with that, I'd like to say, you know, Richard Milhouse Nixon in the Vietnam War got quite the black eye, and the man did so many good things, and I just think that when Henry Kissinger said, you know, you'll be favored more promisely in history, you know, Richard Milhouse Nixon had riots in the streets, the killing of Martin Luther King, the killing of Robert Kennedy. The man had a full plate, made friends, peace talks with China. And I just wanted the American people to know that.
Okay. Thank you, Ray. Appreciate that very much. Little history lesson there, and not an inappropriate one. Let's go to Kevin in Troy. All right, Kevin and Troy, your turn.
Yes. I have a, first of all, let me introduce yourself. I'm a member of the Korean American Institution in Washington and a professor emeritus University at Albany. Now, a couple of things. First of all, that in the Korean War, Kim Song-il was not that close to China. He was afraid of being made a dominance over him. But I have another point to make that according to 38 North, the website for North Korea, Kim Jong-un has a new strategic line, which he's going to concentrate on his domestic economy. And hopefully this is what's pushing him in the direction of negotiations. with your guest like to comment on those two things.
Sure, yeah. So I'll start with the second one. That is the hope, really, is, you know, North Korea has got this economic model on its border called China, right? That transitioned from really a totalitarian state into this economic powerhouse, right? And so the big question is, why the heck has the North not tried to emulate that model? And of course, with the Communist Party still remaining in power, that's key, right? So there is a pathway in the form of China to go from, you know, this sort of internally looking, self-reliant, closed country into one of the, you know, giant economic powers in the world, and the Communist Party still stays in power. Why don't they follow that model? Okay. And so if that's true, and again, it's very hard to know what the internal thinking is. I mean, I think that's hopeful, and that would be nice if they're trying to make this transition. It would be quite easy, in my opinion. The key is the domestic politics of the situation. Can Kim and the military maintain control of the country, not have a division within the elites? Okay, now that's always dangerous. Could there be a division between generals or between factions within North Korea that will then lead to a regime collapse, essentially? The communists, the Chinese, were able to maintain a very rigorous, sort of robust party structure so that the party stayed together even after Deng Xiaoping died in 1997, which that has allowed this continuity and the strength of the party to remain in power and not have elite divisions, which has allowed sort of this economic development to occur and the rise of China. And that's a tricky balance. It depends on the internal dynamics in North Korea. It's not 100%. And that if I had a guess from the outside, that would be probably the main reason why they have not chosen that path. Okay, the elites are quite comfortable in North Korea. You know, Kim and others, they ensure that's part of a lot of where the wealth that they do generate or outside money that comes into Korea, that's really going to the elites. The individual person doesn't really feel benefits from that. And that was one of the one of the criticisms of South Korea when they helped the North. Now, in terms of your first comment, that's, you know, I think you're right. In fact, there's actually a third player here, which is the Soviet Union. They were really the ones that created Kim, the grandfather, in the first place. It wasn't really the Chinese. He spent a good amount of time in Manchuria, northeastern China, fighting kind of like fighting the Japanese, you know, after they were kicked, his family was kicked out of, you know, what was then Korea, but North Korea region. So he started in China. This is Kim, the grandfather, but ultimately ended up in the Soviet Union. And it was the Soviet Unions that really put him in power, hand-selected him. His Russian was as good as his Korean actually language. He really didn't have a close link with Korea. So he was somewhat of a puppet at the time. Now, China comes in, and you're right, both the Soviets and the Chinese, the amazing thing, both the Soviets and the Chinese didn't really support Kim's invasion of the South wholeheartedly. In fact, they said, you're on your own in a way. But ultimately, when he started being defeated, the Chinese and Mao did not want American troops on the border with China. So they were kind of thrown into it in order to prevent that and to push them back.
Now, Professor, you got a comeback on this?
Yep.
Go ahead. But we only have about a minute.
One thing, your guess, is he familiar with the website 38 North?
Yes.
Which is a website of the U.S. Korean Institute in Washington, D.C., of which I'm a member.
Yes, okay. I am familiar, yeah.
Go ahead.
Okay.
That's it? Okay, well, thank you. Thank you so
and
much.
Thank you very much for your time.
Thanks, Kevin. Well, I have to say, I am delighted, Mark, that you've been with us today, Professor Mark Dallas of Union College, who is a specialist in international and comparative economies, as well as East Asia. You really know your stuff, and while there's room for some speculation on all sides of this, like the role of China and some other things, it's great to have you here.
Well, thank you.
It's great to have somebody who really knows what he is talking about. We did not leave anybody on the phone, and so I don't have to apologize to anybody. We're just about out of time. Again, I want to not apologize to anybody, which the script says, left on the line. Thanks, Mark, again.
Thank you.
Underwriting support for Vox Pop comes from Career and Transition LLC, Albany. Dr. Tom Denham, providing individual career guidance, career testing, job strategies, interview preparation, LinkedIn lessons, resume and cover letter writing, Careers and Transition LLC.com, and HMT at the Spa Little Theater, presenting the musical Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat weekends through May 6th at Saratoga Spa State Park, homemadetheater.org, an agricultural stewardship association helping people conserve farmland in the Upper Hudson Valley. We conserve good farmland for good forever. agstewardship.org. And Chester Common Table, Main Street, Chester, Massachusetts. Locally sourced comfort food, beers, wine, and cocktails. Live music every Friday, chestercommontable.com. Thanks, everybody, for joining us today on the Vox Pop. Our engineer is Zach Malloy. Thanks to Colleen O'Connell for answering the phones. Our producer is Jim Lavoulis. I'm Alan Shartok. Stay tuned now for a news update.